Seth, are you finished hugging everyone?
All right, we can get started, right? Hello, everybody.
Hi.
Y'all got to sound lively.
Thousand people.
All power to the people, all power through the people, through the people, right? That's right. We don't need no representatives that just want to just take our power from us, right? Our creativity. All right? And with that, you know, like, I'm glad to see this crowd. We're here today. We want to hear Lorenzo Comboa Irving, who's in town. And he's on the road constantly. I think he's feeling a lot of that and a little under the weather. That don't need, you know, he needs the microphone more because his voice is in his voice. But it's an honor for me to introduce him because in my own development, politically, coming from out of the Black Panther Party, the same as him, Marxist-Leninist, Maoist organization, having a chance to reflect on that and seeing a lot of the errors that we made in the Panther Party and trying to find some other ways of looking at the world and organizing, respecting people with dignity, I turned towards more anti-authoritarian and Marxist ideas myself. And it was in prison when I first learned about him. He was in prison at the time, and so was I. We never ran across each other, though, because a lot of times the federal government had this thing about keeping revolutionaries from each other. But when he first put out Anarchism in the Black Revolution was when we started getting wind of it. And was that a good time for me? Because being in prison, it allows you to reflect on your past. It's a good way to reflect on your past. It may not be a great situation, but you got to use it. So in reading that, I had a chance to like question structures. I had a chance to question what part culture plays into motivating people to move towards certain organizations or ways of thinking. And it gave me a lot of things to think about. And I came out of prison. I continued on that path and began to read more and more anarchism and seeing so much value in it. Since he hit the street, he's been active. Writing, speaking, organizing within the United States, and he has even been outside of the country. Had a wonderful experience in Australia, where the government there didn't feel like he should be talking to the indigenous people about freedom, and they locked him up, you know. Brought back, you know, some old time memories, you know. But the good thing about the internet was that as soon as that happened, people was on the internet. Lorenzo's locked up. We need to do some things. I know right here in New York, we went to the Australian embassy and did our little protest, let them know we didn't like it, and that they need to treat him right. So he's been traveling, and he's been spreading the message of anarchism from a Black perspective. And saying from a Black perspective means that this is not just traditional classical anarchism. You know, anytime you come from a people's indigenous experience, it's going to shake some of this classical, traditional stuff up. And I think that's what he has done. He's done it in a good way. There's a growing movement in the United States amongst anarchists, you know, for the first time in many, many years. But it has increased a lot of dialogue, a lot of debate, a lot of discussion. And from out of that, we're challenged to grow through some very painful things that we have to face as people who want to create a truly free society without hierarchy, without racism, sexism, and all the phobias. So with that, I want to bring him on. Hopefully that voice will hold through. And maybe at some point we'll have a chance to get some good question and answer in. But before we bring them on, there's three things I want to announce. That there's a box in the back for donations that go towards the new edition of Anarchism and the Black Revolution that he's presently working on. And he still needs money to complete that. It was told us that there's a study group on his book going on, and there's, I think, a sign-up sheet in the back there also. And also as part of the fundraising, they have some food over here. So if people hungry, you can help with the fundraising by buying some food and stuff like that. Alright? So, with that said, with this great crowd that we have here, and our great speaker here, and someone who inspires me, I bring on Lorenzo from Bo Irving.
I hope you don't mind if I sit here while I talk most of the time. This thing has really robbed a lot of energy of mine. You know, I'm used to raising hell, jumping around the room and all that kind of thing. And I just have to turn it down a notch a little bit, or it's forcing me to turn it down a notch. First of all, let me say it's a pleasure to be here once again in New York City. It's been some time since I've been here, actually. It's even been longer since I've spoken here. I haven't seen my brother here in quite a while, until just recently this year. Let me thank everybody for helping to do this. Brooke and, of course, my brother Ashanti here, and some of the other great folks I've met since I've been here that are working with them. My whole perspective on all this stuff, you know, the talks I've been giving and the work I've been doing and all that, it's just as me as a person doing what has got to be done. I'm no hero. I'm no leader in the sense that I'm trying to force people to follow my personality. I'm just an ordinary person who has been confronted with extraordinary events. And out of that, you know, being confronted with that, having to then carry on the struggle. There were people who came before me, and it's always good to pay your respects to people. You know, there were people who came before me, you know, the person who was a mentor in my life was Willie Ricks, you know, who's been called the best organizer, bar none, in the whole civil rights period, who was responsible for the concept of black power, who organized in Mississippi, Alabama, underground, in fact, for many years. And never got any mass credit. Most people to this very day don't even know his name. They think Stokely Carmichael and others, and I use their slave names, they think that they were the ones who came with the concept of black power. And it's always important to understand that there are unsung heroes. People believe that everybody they see on television today, you know, these spokespersons, black spokespersons of one sort or another, that somehow those are the leaders, the authentic leaders of the people. And the first thing you have to ask yourself is that if it was true that these were some leadership and that they're saying things that are really a threat to the state, would they be allowed to do that? If we say that the state and the authorities are as bloodthirsty as we know them to be, then they would not allow you to speak unless they had an ulterior motive. And what they do, what the state and the government does, it's important to understand this, that they make people, they shape people as so-called leaders. And they do it because they want to create a person that's larger than life. And they also want to create people that they can control. This is one of the reasons, in this period especially, in this period since the black struggle of the 1960s, the black revolution I call it, the 1960s, and the, you know, the anti-war movement and all that, since that period, they picked the persons and made them media stars. So I'm not one of those people. I'm an ordinary person. And I don't have any entourage or any of that kind of stuff, you know, although I got friends here. So that's important to lay that out up front. Now, if I was to look at, you know, my own life, and everybody has a place where they start. It's important. You can't understand where somebody is coming from. You can't understand their politics until you understand something about what they live. You've got to be walking in their shoes, in a matter of speaking. And for me, you know, as a young person growing up in the South and the coming of the civil rights movement, the sit-ins, especially the youth-based wing of the civil rights movement in 1960. And in my case, I was living in Chattanooga, Tennessee, going to a junior high school. And the talk was all about what had been happening in the South, the demonstrations, the black people first making their first steps to oppose segregation, to overthrow the segregationist system. And that was the first glimmer of political consciousness for me. And to see black people, to see ordinary people not just the thing you got to bear in mind, there were two types of leadership in the South. And among the movement, we discussed it a lot. On the one hand, you had the charismatic leadership of Dr. Martin Luther King and these blacks of the middle class, like, you know, preachers and so forth. And then you had the students who basically were no name. They weren't known by their names. SNCC people. He was just known as SNCC. I'm with SNCC. You know, that was just it. Organization. And their whole thing was not to exalt leadership, but to deal with ordinary folks and empower them in their own communities. And the organizer wasn't there to pimp somebody or push some specific politics of their own as much as they were to empower people and support and understand. So those were my first glimmers of mass struggle, and my anti-authoritarian consciousness came out of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And it's important to understand that there really hasn't been very few organizations since that time that has used anti-authoritarian politics in its organizing, especially in the black movement I'm speaking of particularly. So, at that time, having been shown what the power of the masses was like, having seen with my own eyes how people could change not only the institutions that were ruling over them, but could ultimately overthrow the existing status quo. You know, even though I was thinking of it in terms like this. And most people at the time, the stuff that's happening, they don't think about it in sociological terms and other bullshit like that. They don't think like that. They see what's happening and they respond to what's happening. And the thing is, it's like being in love. If you ain't got no passion for revolutionary struggle, you will never be a fucking revolutionary. You'll never get it. You know, if you don't have any love. This is about love. This is about struggling for the people. And you're part of the people. It's important to understand that. If people get this idea that they've got all the theory and the rhetoric and all that down, and they don't understand that if they're not part of the people, what the hell are you struggling for? You know, you are part of the so-called masses. That's extremely important to understand. So my understanding, my first baptism came with the fire of that struggle. And we were fighting the Ku Klux Klan in the street. And the thing developed in Chattanooga differently than it did in a lot of other cities. And if you go back and you read all these histories of the sit-ins and so forth in most cities around in the South, you won't find very much on Chattanooga. And it's because it didn't conform to what the later middle class ideals and so forth was, of the nonviolence and letting people spit on you and hit you and all. These people resisted. These black people, when they would go into the department stores, when they went into the department stores and took them over and so forth, when the racists came out there and hit people or spit on people, they responded by knocking the hell out of them. You know, they weren't turning on another cheek. Oh, you can hit me on this side too. Or you can spit on me up here. They weren't going for that. You know, they weren't brainwashed with that. They resisted just as any normal human being would. And it's really, really important to understand, you know, how these character struggles develop, because they are part of what shapes your consciousness. Okay, so that's where I'm coming from originally. Then, having become part of this movement, and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee lasted 10 years, and it went through various transformations, just like the so-called Civil Rights Movement did. And it became a black power organization. As I said, Willie Rich was extremely important in shaping that concept and working in with the masses of people in Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia and to try to build a new kind of movement. Now, I don't know, frankly, if SNCC itself became that new kind of movement, even though it was extremely important. And all of the radical forces of the 1960s, of that period, certainly owes its debt of gratitude to that organization. You know, it was just the other the anti-war movement. All of many of the activists that went into most of the social change organizations in that period of the late 1960s came out of SNCC. The black struggle shaped the entire period at that time. And of course, the Black Panther Party even came out of that consciousness as well and merged with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in 1967. And that was how I made my entry into it. It's important to understand that since we know that the masses make a revolutionary struggle, not so-called leaders, that the equation needs to be shifted. It isn't as though some
authoritarian vanguardist party dictates to people. I don't think the Black Panther Party would have been successful if it had just followed a strict prescription by being a vanguard organization and had a relationship with the masses that they were expendable and this sort of thing. They had programs. In fact, one state has like 40 different programs that were mass programs, everything related to sickle cell anemia, and they was the first organization treating sickle cell anemia. It wasn't the federal government. It wasn't the damn, or is it that federal agency that supposedly treats all manner of illnesses? It was the Black Panther Party. It was the first organization that discovered it. I knew a woman, that time was a very important woman in my life, and lived in the same city I did, and for years we never knew what the hell was wrong with her. She had illnesses, she'd faint and all this stuff. What is with the mother? Nobody ever knew what was wrong with her for years and years and years. And it was only later that I found out it was sickle cell anemia. And it was a Black Panther Party that had three vans and all this and go into the community and treat people. And this is when I first found out about it. So I know a small organization, if you will, that has the allegiance of the masses, that is part of the mass movement, can accomplish a great deal. Well, of course, the government understood this as well. They understood how a movement like the Black Panther Party, and I'm just speaking about it in passing, but they understood how a movement like this could be a terrible threat to state control. And it wasn't because they were carrying firearms, it wasn't because they would march around in black fatigues and all this stuff. And it's important to understand it because there's folks that are pretending now to be revolutionaries, pretending to be Black Panthers and all that. So it's understanding, it wasn't the uniform, it wasn't the beret, it wasn't none of it. It was the attachment to the masses of people and the bringing of programs so that poor people had something to fight for. If people, if you don't connect with people and you ain't got, and they don't feel like they got something to fight for, then you cannot expect them to stand up. That's the way it works. And so from that standpoint, it was extremely important to understand that. Many people draw the wrong conclusions from that. They think that the issue is the correct line. You know, so that in every set of circumstances, you just flip the page 57. Sherman Miles has stated on several occasions that the masses of people will rise up and you try to stimulate. 43. You must repress all counter-revolutionaries. Anyone who doesn't agree with you, crush them. You know, just on, people believe that this is the way to proceed. And this ain't it. You got to be in there in the community. You got to organize the hood, as they say now. And it, you know, I figured that one out myself. Damn, I don't know why anybody else ain't figured it out. You know, you got to organize the hood. You got to be part of the hood. You know, you got to be part of the mass. You know, there's masses and there's classes and there's asses. And we should get all of them mixed together. It looks like the asses are trying to lead the masses and the classes. But, you know, you get hung up on analysis for analysis' sake. And that's why the so-called left, and in this period, is not accomplishing a damn thing. All they're doing, you know, many of them are saying that all we can do at this stage is keep our organizations alive. We can't do a damn thing about what's happening to people. We can't do nothing about the fact that there's 2 million people in the prison system. You know, I don't hear nobody hardly talking about that. 2 million people in the prison system, and I don't hear no so-called black leaders saying a damn thing about it. I don't see none of the so-called revolutionaries doing nothing about it, to be quite honest with you, all these so-called organizations that are led by leaders over in France and Germany. I don't see nothing being done about that, you know. And I think that these are the kind of real life questions and issues that affect people, not just some rhetoric out of some book that's 50 years old or 100 years old, and they read it like the Bible, you know, hold it like the sacred text and bring it out there and flip it over and up. And as we were saying, if the masses will rise up under the yoke, away from the yoke of the bourgeoisie establishment, then we will know that the time has arisen for the revolutionary proletariat to jump into action and to seize power in the name of the masses, holding that power with numerous executions, holding that power. He's holding that power with a turgid bourgeoisie, a new bourgeoisie. I mean, it's just ridiculous, you know. And you look at histories, you go through history. And it's important to look at history as a real thing, not just some bullshit that somebody's written. You know, if people are being killed, if you kill 10,000 people, and you do it in the name of the party, I'm not saying in the course of a civil war, fighting a war, whatever, but if you kill your own people, and you know, if you kill people just because they disagree with you, that's a dictatorship. Ain't no dictatorship of the proletariat. That's a damn dictatorship, period. They'll kill your ass if you get up and say something. Kill you maybe sometime if you won't. And so you gotta lay at the foot of forces what crimes they've committed, as well as the so-called victories. You know what I'm saying? You gotta be able to do it. So the world we're living in today, we gotta look at that, especially as anarchists and as revolutionists, we gotta look and say, you know what? We need to build a new force. We can't allow ourselves to be crippled by not getting out in the communities and organizing door to door. We got to be talking to people who on the block we live with. We got to be building programs where they can survive, whether they are cooperatives, various sorts of housing, food, or whatever. Have you noticed the fact that there's very few inner city food courts?
Mm-hmm.
Have you done that in most cities you go to? You got all these white liberals over somewhere,
right,
that have got all these services, you know what I'm talking about, all this stuff, and they're eating fine, and you know, eating green vegetables and all that, and talking about it, and preaching you, some poor person, oh, we're eating great over here, and if you could just eat some of what we've eaten, you'd be in perfect health, and so, yeah, I'm damn sure you would. If you could. So what we got to do is we've got to take and get some of those programs and resources and get them in the hands of the people who need them. And that was one of the strengths of a group like the Black Panther Party. And I think that there's a lot of romanticism about the Black Panther Party today. And I don't think me and my brother have that romanticism. We understood it as a program, as a movement that arose at a certain historical moment. And the things that they provided were the things that propelled it and made it a real serious force. There were other groups around at that time, by the way, that called themselves Black Revolutionary, this, that, and other, that weren't as successful because they didn't have a method of reaching the masses of people. I looked at the anarchist movement, you know, and I became an anarchist while I was in prison, and I was actually acquainted with anarchist politics while I was in prison. And I think most people, even today, especially most blacks and other people of color, even today, are acquainted with anarchist politics through the prison system. Some of them say, through some of my writings, well, that may be fine and dandy. But I think they're acquainted with it because that is where they get access to it. And that's a shame and a disgrace. I think on the streets, people should be able to pick up a newspaper. At least we're not saying that we won't. Somebody said, well, we don't want white people down in our community. Well, that's true. We don't want them coming down telling people what to do. But it's important to put ideas across, put ideas out there, and then you come to your own conclusions. You know, if they don't have the ideas, how can they then arrive at the conclusions that you want them to arrive at? I mean, this should be quite obvious and, you know, it beyond dispute. You know, we think that they should just come to us. We're going to set up an info shop in down in the suburbs, and they should just come over there, and then they'll give you the knowledge. This is the way we think it should be done. Nah. Don't work like that. Don't work like that at all. We need to have resources. We need to have programs where the people are. Otherwise, what is the point of it? They're just for the bourgeoisie and for the well-off classes. You know, and I think that's one of the failings in this period of not only the anarchist movement and the left. They ain't got it figured out yet. And the sad part is, even when they're in poor communities, they almost serve as some sort of stalking horse for the developers and all these other agents to come in and reclaim the community and put the white youngest back in and destroy those communities. So we got some of the real serious things to talk about in a real sense that happened. That you know they're happening, but ain't nobody talking about it. Ain't nobody doing it about it. They want to feed you a line of bullshit. I don't deal with that kind of thing. I try to deal with reality because I'm not a celebrity, because I'm not a college professor, because I'm somebody that comes right out the hood, stayed in the hood now for that matter, and been poor all my life. So I understand it. And I've developed a point of view about it based on the things I've seen in my own life. See, it ain't like somebody's read, just said I've read a bunch of books and come to some conclusions. It is because I've been able, and I think the brother was saying the same thing. That's why I was saying, yeah, he's got it down. It's the same thing. We came to understanding based on real life's experiences. See, and if you come to that conclusion, you can incorporate something within your being, and it, every day you're struggling. Somebody says, well, how in the hell can you keep doing this 30 or 40 years? It's in my system. It's me. It's what I'm about. It ain't no shit I'm just adopting today, and next week you see me, I'm a Republican. I mean, this is what I'm about, and they can't shake it out of me. They put me in prison. They beat me. Every country in the world I've gone through bullshit. Some countries have banned me now, even Canada. It's banned. And, you know... And if it's something that you believe in, and it's something that's part of your being, they can't separate you from it. It's really, really important to understand it. So this is why I really think we're going to win, in the sense, if winning means we're going to be able to build a movement that touches, that's a movement for total liberation that touches everybody in this country and in the world. If it means that we're going to create a new political force that can challenge the existing status quo, the capitalist state, the capitalist system, worldwide capitalist system, imperialism, whatever you want to call it. If it means that, then I think we are in position to defeat that. But the most important thing is, it's not so much that we'd be able to defeat that, because we can do that. But we'd be able to erect a new society on a world scale. And I don't have, I can't come and say, well, you know, I've got it all figured out, y'all, and here's my new book for $17.95. You can have it, and just go out and preach to the people. It'll happen. Now, there are people who do that. There are people who do that, but I ain't one of them. And so what I'm really saying is that you got to be where you are. Like the old preacher said, cast down your bucket, brother. Cast down your bucket. But what he's saying is that wherever you are, that's where you work.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
You know, you ain't got to go looking for something to happen. Well, let's go. This week we're going over to China. Next week we're going over here. That's the criticism I have of anti-globalization movies. Although I think it's important that they are confronting those capitalists. I'm happy to see that. But ultimately, you've got to be able to do local work. And they go into communities and don't connect with the local communities. Like people say, who are these crazy white people running around here? You know, all this shit's going on in the street, fighting the shit. You know, and so who are these crazy white people? What's this all about? You know, they can't relate to it. They can't relate to it. But if you gave people the dignity and respect of going into their communities and talking to folks and prepping it that way, then you wouldn't have so many white faces, for one thing. But you'd also be able to connect with people and mobilize them. It's part of what your force is, you see. And I think that's the failure of the left generally, and of the anarchist movement as well, is that it ain't got there yet. It ain't got there yet. It's important. And that's why I'm always, especially when you are launching these salvos at them, whatever the hell it is, salvo or criticism or whatever the hell it is, I'm going to launch it when I think it's necessary. Not to weaken the movement. I'm still a part of it just because I criticize like your own family. Hell, I could criticize members of my family. Don't mean I'm leaving and I'm joining somebody else. We're not talking about it. We ain't talking about that. But what we are saying is that we have to correct things within our own movement. We've got to look for a new direction. You see what I'm saying? If you were trying to walk out the door and you walked into the wall here, would you keep walking into the damn wall? Or would you look for another door? You know, what sense would that make? Damn, I can't get out of here. Bam, baby. Well, damn, I gotta look for another door somewhere. There it is. And go there. You see? You look. But yet people politically continue to run into the wall.
Well, oh my goodness, in 1917, they did this in words. Why in 1968, boy, as they did this, and it seemed to work. Well, they did in the 60s, and it worked. These ain't the 60s. You know, this is a different period of time. And to make things work, you gotta do a little research. You gotta go down and talk to folks. And you gotta craft something based on the material conditions that exist today. And the fact that 2 million people are in prison in the United States, and that the United States leads the entire world in the number of people who are confined. The fact that the United States has got all these people sleeping in the streets. And check this out. Wasn't no damn people sleeping in no street in the 1960s? Millions of people. I'm not saying there wasn't no poor people. But wasn't no damn millions of people sleeping in the street. Don't you dig that something has happened, that the capitalist economy has transformed, that they've deindustrialized, and all these people who had jobs in the inner city have now been made expendable, and now they've been put in the penitentiary.
That's right.
Or shot down in the damn streets. That's what's happening. See what I'm saying? It's important to know what's happening. So my mother said, medicine tastes awful, but it'll make you feel better.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Everybody wants to hear some sweet shit. Sweet syrupy shit. Oh, you're wonderful. You're doing a great job. Just keep it up. You know, everything's wonderful, lovely. I'm a motivational speaker. Just rise up and float like a cloud. I can only face it like this. I was going to Atlanta. We were first trying to build Black autonomy in Atlanta. And I went to this bookstore, and this brother was sympathetic to what we were doing. He had been an old line rapper himself. He was sympathetic to Black autonomy. But he had to pay the bills. And so he had all these weird-ass cups in there. So I'm going there and went in 30 minutes early, and everybody was in there doing this. Screaming and hollering. Oh! And this cat was going around. I don't know, man. He just going around like this.
Yes, brothers and sisters. Yes! Yes! People were just, oh!
Oh, my! They speak it! What the hell is going on in here?
And it was a pyramid pop. Pyramid pop. Come on, y'all. Tossing 10s and 20s and 50, when got told 50 over in there. With his pyramid power. The blessing cloth.
Hey, brother, the blessing cross. I've got the blessing cloth here. Come on, brother. Come on now. Who's got $75? Come on. I know somebody got $75. This is not, it's typical of the contemporary period.
Yeah.
This is what is happening right now.
Mm-hmm.
This is why these con man preachers can get on there and say, oh Lord Jesus is coming to save all of you. But you've got to buy a way. You got to buy a ticket. You got to buy a ticket to get on the train. Jesus Christ, don't come down here and don't come cheap. You know, and tell people that they have got to pay. And they're on television now and talking to millions of people. You dig what I'm saying? Millions of people listen to this bullshit. And they're out organizing us, you know. The Jehovah's Witnesses, I see them in my community every day. I have to run their ass apart my door. Get out of here, man. What the hell about that? Don't tell me what you're in here. I want you all that stuff. But every week they're there. Persistence. Sincerity.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we could do this with our movement, if we could go in the community, even if people say, I don't hear stuff, slam the door in your face, and that will happen. If you are an aggressive organizer, that will happen. You get used to that. You don't personalize it. But it's effective to keep going there because eventually people will start listening to you. And at this time, movements are being built. But the anarchist movement continues to want to stay on college campuses and all this kind of shit, just among groups of little white kids over in some place and saving the whales and all this kind of stuff and squeezing the chipmunks. And I was in a place and somebody said, now I've been labeled as a primitivist. Yeah, I'm a primitivist now. So I said, he's a primitivist now. And all he cares about is trees and chipmunks and all that sort of bullshit.
Well,
let me tell you something.
I just can't turn my mind off to what is happening in the real world. You know, I mean, I try to be on a fairly decent level with every wing of the existing anarchist movement. Even though a criticalist movement as a whole, I made my critiques, but they're political critiques, they aren't personal. But, you know, this is ridiculous. You know, I go and speak on behalf of some people who have been railroaded to prison. And all of a sudden, I'm a primitivist now. I'm working, all I'm caring about is the trees and the wild nature and all this kind of stuff. It's ridiculous. I think, you know, and most of us, especially people of color, have got to be able to build a tendency. And we are going to build a tendency. In fact, next year, we are working on having a conference for anarchist people of color. Presumably, it'll be in Michigan. There's still some details to be worked out and everything, but we're attempting to do that. It's been something that I've been trying to talk to people about a long time. I think there are now enough people of color and on the fringes of the existing anarchist movement that are willing to come together to some sort of tendency. I think there are enough of us. And that in itself is amazing to me. My brother here, you know, we go way back. We have a lot of things in common. If they shoot me, he'll take my place, or vice versa. Whatever the case is. And we want to be able to build a movement that is a real authentic movement for this period. It's really important to understand that. We want to build a movement, of course, in our own communities. And I think that's been the biggest failing of anarchism. When I wrote the book, Anarchism and the Black Revolution, I was doing life in prison. In fact, double life in prison, locked up in a control unit, prison, subjected to behavior modification, all sorts of bullshit like this. And in those circumstances, to keep my own sanity and to also express a point of view that had never been heard in the anarchist movement, heard very little in the left, I wrote this small pamphlet called Anarchism and Black Revolution and smuggled it out to the streets and a group in New York here, some strange white people, but still, yeah, a good group of anarchists published it, and it came out as a small pamphlet. And that small pamphlet, which I had written and you know, not forgotten about it, but had not had that much contact with people I got out of prison, that small pamphlet has influenced people all over the world. That amazes me. That absolutely, utterly amazes me. And, of course, when I got out of prison in 1983, I immediately threw myself into organizing work. Now, some people will tell you that you should look out for your own ass first and all that. And I guess if I was one of those kind of people, I would have done that. But my thing was that I'd gone to prison as an activist, and I'm coming out the same way. I ain't no hero, and I said I wasn't trying to be no hero or heroic effort. I could have been returned to prison very simply by the government on a parole violation. And many people have been railroaded back. Who nailed would come to my defense? I don't know. But my opinion about the matter was that I needed to do all the things I said I was going to do. Many people get out of prison. Let's be quite real about this. Many people get out of prison, whether they're activists or whatever they are, and when they stop and look back, they get scared shitless and they don't do nothing else in their life. Yeah. And that's just a fact. And I'm not saying this as a put down, you know, but it's so it shows you the kind of commitment that you have to make, like someone like Brother Ashanti, who did serious time, and others have to make just by putting it out like that, putting themselves back into the struggle. See, because they got records on us. They might not know who y'all is. Y'all put on masks and ride around and crap in the head and all that kind of bullshit and demonstrations. And they know y'all white folks anyway, unless you do anything. Oh, he hit me with a stick, but he's all right. It's another white man. You know. But, you know, I'm serious. I'm making a joke of this. I'm not saying to be denigrating, but it is true. If they were dealing with black people in the streets fighting them in the same fashion that the anti-globalization movement has been dealing with the so-called black bloc and all that shit, there'd have been some dead bodies down there. It'd have been deadly force used. And you know, and let's just be clear about that. But
I was involved in all this stuff, man, and when I got out of Chattanooga, came back to Chattanooga, and, which is a racist hellhole, then and now, always has been. But I was organizing, the Ku Klux Klan was on my case, the cops were trying to frame me and send me back in prison, and all that kind of stuff. They even went to my parole office and tried to get him to go along with it. And to his credit, you know, he refused to do it. He said, ain't nobody going to be railroaded on my damn role. You know, you need to go somewhere else. Of course, he was the only black officer there anyway. And nobody else wanted to take the case. He was all scared. You know, the white people, we don't want him here. Go bring him here. So, you know, he was only somebody who handled my case. As long as I didn't do something to get myself arrested, you know, on a major felony, he wasn't going to do anything. He just let me do anything I wanted to do, any kind of organizing. He said, well, he's got a First Amendment right to do that. I'm not going to put him back in jail for that. You know. And many of our officers will. They'll put you back for looking at them wrong. I don't like your looks. You're going back. You know. So for me to do this, I had an understanding that, you know, it was a commitment I made. I said, you know what? I may go back, and they may have to kill me out here, whatever. I don't know. But I won't do this. Somebody's got to do it. And I was like pushed into it, you know, because there was nobody there willing to speak up. You know, nobody was there. You had these two black women there. They were by themselves. One woman's father had been murdered by the city police. And her friend, they were the only ones speaking up. All the so-called civil rights organizations, which were bought out by the white power structure, paid off. Many of them was in the middle class anyway, and they wouldn't go shake a stick at a snake. And they say down there, and you know, so I really didn't have a choice anyway. They needed someone who was strong and somebody who was knowledgeable and all that. And so I got kind of pushed into the limelight, if you want to call it that. And we built a movement, and we built it called this VAG, already called it anymore, the Concerned Citizens for Justice. And we were fighting around police brutality. Ultimately, it became a poor people's movement, and an authentic poor people's movement, you know. And at first it was an all-black movement, and we were like putting real serious pressure on the government and over around police brutality, had demonstrations all the time. Excuse me. We had demonstrations all the time, you know. There were times when the Klan and all had contracts, and we had to carry, secretly, if I couldn't carry a piece, well, somebody would be with me with a weapon, you know, and I'd sleep in different places and all this kind of stuff, you know. So it got real intense there over those years. But I got through it. You know, I got through it. I never got really arrested. When they tried to come and frame cases on me, they tried to frame a case one time of a bombing of a black preacher's van. The Klan would have bombed that man's van. But because it was known we had political differences, they tried to frame me for it. And the DEA and the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Division people come running down to my house and my family's house and claiming that, you know, that I'd bombed the van and this and that, and they're going to investigate me, blah, blah, blah. And we were able to defeat those charges because I brought it out to the people. I said, you know, this is what happened. This happened. Y'all need to know this. They're trying to frame me, put me in prison. I got on, you know, local television, got on and put the word out. And so they had to back off of that. They backed off of that particular instance. There were other times they tried to frame charges on me. You know, one time claiming that I had a gun, a weapons cache in my mother's house, hid in the basement. They come running over there trying to get in the house. And she said, it's just one gun in here, and that gun belongs to me. She said, this is my gun. It's a licensed weapon. So you are not bringing your ass in my house. No. And if you want to find out how this one gun works, I will show you how it works. These old women, these old, you know, boy, older women in the South and all that, their fathers taught them how to shoot. And they didn't play no bush. You know, coming in my house, no son, you ain't coming here, I don't care who you are. You got a power fellow government, you better bring all your ass down here then. President Reagan, he ain't coming here. You know, and she would not let them in. And they said, well, we just want to dust the weapon for press. She said, he ain't had this gun, this is my gun, this is a licensed weapon. You are not coming in here. And they backed out. They backed all those cop cars and all that stuff. They backed off and left. And then, they, you know, later on, they had me come down to, you know, to the thing. I had my attorney with me by then. They were just railroad, having Bogart me to come down there without a attorney. I'm just going to disappear. They had me back in the penitentiary before everybody would know what happened. I wouldn't fall in for that. So we made a public. Every time they tried to do something to me, we would make a public spectacle of it.
So they had to back out. Well, you're not after Mr. Irvin. Who's saying that? We're not. He's mistaken about that. Why he was writing his work out here. Yeah, right. And so they would just, we'd beat them back. It's important to know these things because organizing ain't fun necessarily. I mean, if you try to make it fun, it can be dangerous though. In a certain set of circumstances, it can be dangerous. And in that town, there were as many people killed as in New York City. Check that out. You know, there are people getting killed. We documented some 60 cases in the course of, I think it was a 9 or 10 year period. 60-some cases, 65 cases of black people being killed by the police department. Shot and killed, hung from a railroad trestle, all kinds of stuff. All, you know, murderous, racist violence. Kind of stuff that went on in the 60s and they claimed.
Well, that doesn't happen here anymore. This is a new South. New South. Well, we got Jimmy Carter, the president. Things are great.
You know, all this kind of stuff. These rednecks were killing people anyway. You know, had been doing it for years down in that place. And so we organized. We started letting people around the country know about it. And so we had the national demonstrations down there and everything. You know, the only demonstration held over those church burnings took place in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Yes.
All these preachers and all of them sold out to Jimmy, sold out to Clinton. Yes. Sold out to Clinton because he was running for office. Y'all don't make no noise because I'm running for re-election. Y'all might call him being election there. And all these so-called civil rights leaders and so forth wouldn't do a damn thing. So we had a demonstration ourselves in Chattanooga because they had burned a church. They had burned some activist homes down also. A friend of mine, in fact, was a labor union activist, and they burned his house down. And everything. And then, so we had a big demonstration around that. So this is the kind of thing that you confronted with in the spirit. You also confronted with treachery, class treachery, by so-called civil rights and progressive groups and all this other garbage. Their role, they're paid to sell you out.
Right.
Their role is to capture you and to capture your organizing within a certain framework that doesn't challenge the status quo. It's important to understand that. That also is one of the weaknesses of the anti-globalization movement. Because they got forces that are in there that ultimately will be sharpening the knives to cut their throat. You know,
yep.
Of the anarchists. And they just need to understand that. And not think, well, we got some wind under our sails. We some bad mothers. No, you get stabbed dead in your back. Look at that. You got to know what you are dealing with. You got to know the real class forces, not just the state. We know the state's there. We know in opposition to the state, the international capitalist class and all that. You ain't just got to be able to run no line about that. You got to understand in the real world what all this stuff means. And hey, white folks can't speak for black folks. Rich folks or people from middle class can't speak for poor folks. And folks in this part of the world, in the West, cannot advocate and speak for people in the third world. They got to be able to develop their own voices and become a force in their own liberation. Dig that. And why is that important? Because you have got, in this period, the concept of the advocate. The advocate. I'm speaking for all of those people over in Latin America. Well, what the hell? They can't speak for themselves?
Yeah.
Why don't you just get some money together and bring some of those people here to speak for themselves? You know, here's somebody wallowing in luxury. Comes from a rich family. And I'm not saying that people who, you know, come out of middle class or come out of even wealth can't become, you know, what they call, can't commit class suicide, whatever you want to call it. I don't even call it this, but just unite with the people. It doesn't mean that they can't and that you shouldn't adopt them as allies. But it's important to understand that their politics, their political baggage, cannot be allowed to dominate any movement for social change. It is deadly. It is deadly. So it's important to understand that. And that is a weakness of the contemporary movement. Somebody says, well, what do you think of the anti-globalization movement? And that's some of the things I put out there. I also think that at the time of September 11th, and I criticized them about this, when they were getting ready to have a big demonstration in Washington, D.C., they counseled them. I'm saying that what you should not have counseled, what you should have done was to understand that the same class forces that have been starving fucking people to death in the third world are the same class forces that are fomenting war.
Mm-hmm.
And the real task here is to take the worldwide network that you have created and turn it into an anti-war movement. And turn it into a movement not just to end the war, but to end the system that creates war. See what I'm saying? And that is simple. And that is simple also. And so I think that the potential to create a new anarchist politic, the potential to create a new movement, and the potential to create a new new world. I think that potential is there, you know. But, you know, potential is like most things in life. They are not often realized. And we want to be able to maximize it by having an understanding going in. We ain't got to have no class line and all this other garbage that people tell you. So that somebody who's never been poor in their life and all this can then get up and you know, I don't know where people get this idea that because you don't bathe and because you wear jeans, dirty jeans and all this other bullshit, that somehow this washes away years of privilege. Washes away centuries of privilege. It don't happen that way. No, you have to walk the walk and talk the talk and put your ass on the line for why I will ever accept you and others like you, you know, will ever accept you. And if people who do come out of privileged classes are willing to do that, then they are fair weather friends.
Mm-hmm.
As long as shit is cool at the moment, as long ain't nothing happening, as long as there is not a crisis, as long as people are not being shot in the street, as there's white folks being shot in the street, everything's cool. No, but when it gets to the stage where they will even start shooting, they shot a white man, my God, things have really gotten serious now. You know, this is some craziness. I recall the Kent State shooting, and I also recall the Jackson State shooting, and the Orange, and the shooting at in Orange, South Carolina, Orangeburg, South Carolina. I recall that, but I don't ever recall, other than black people, anyone really bringing it up as examples of police state abuse and the destruction of the anti-war movement. I don't recall that, even to this day. And I think it is part of the understanding among many whites that black life does not have the same value. Does not have the same value. And I think that we, the new anti-racist consciousness, which needs to be developed within the progressive movement itself, within the anarchist movement itself, within all the so-called left movements itself, will understand that and will, in fact, not be captured by this kind of opportunism where it thinks that white people can lead a movement of its own and get free. You know, this is one of the only countries I've ever been in. I guess because the United States was created as a white nation, and because they had slaves, they have always postured about freedom, and oh, we are protecting our freedoms, and so we've got to have a Homeland Security Act, and we've got to have the U.S. Patriot Act, and we're protecting our freedoms from all these poor people, these terrorists. You know, and they think that, you know, the people that run the state and the people who have consistently maintained the state believe that. I think that many people, so-called even activists, believe some of that. That somehow it's a question of if white people are being freed, well, everybody's being freed. No, it don't work that way. It doesn't work that way even nearly. You know, one of the things for me, you know, I'm this kind of person that tries to find the real deal in any situation. And in this time we're in right now, this is a very dangerous period. Somebody asked me the other night about COINTELPRO. Well, COINTELPRO was in response to actually existing effective revolutionary and political movements. You know, it was used against, in its most murderous form, against the Black Panther Party. And against the black movement generally, assassinated leaders, not only you know, national leaders like Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, but also assassinated on the local level, Carl Hampton and others like that.
and other people that you may not have heard of. It had imprisoned many others. Some people are in prison today. Many. There are some black men that have been in prison for over 30 years now, right now. And some of them, most people don't even know who the hell they are. Don't know who the hell they are. And so what I'm getting at here is that this movement that comes into existence in this period has to be about claiming some of those people. It has to be about doing organizing around political prisoners. But it also has to understand in this period, the period has changed so that now there is mass imprisonment and criminalization of the youth. The OCONTELPRO was designed to destroy movements that were powerful. Black Panther Party was powerful. In fact, the rationale for destroying the Black Panther Party, as given by J. Edgar Hoover, it was the greatest threat to internal security in the United States in its long history. That's a hell of a comment. So they saw it as, you know, they created this COINTELPRO to destroy that. Now, however, the USA Patriot Act and all these things are designed to create state security to the degree that all dissent and organizing is impossible. And we're going to see a variety of repressive measures. And let's not get fooled into thinking that the next attack on America, the next attack on America is coming with Al-Qaeda or some bullshit. That these people are not capable of doing a provocative act of their own. The security agencies in this country will blow up a building. Well, in this city, and my brother will tell you, he'll be happy to tell you, they railroaded Black Panthers in the Panther 21 case. Claiming that they did the same shit that they're accusing today Islamic people and all this kind of thing for. You dig that? Flip, 1968. Flip, 2002. And you can understand that the state is only worried about maintaining control. Now, they're not doing these things from a position of strength, however. They're doing it from a position of weakness. They are being challenged around the world. Now, they're being challenged by some forces, truthfully, that we cannot politically sympathize with. You know what I'm saying? Some of these right-wing religious groups and so forth. But in terms of the world the way it is today, and the way that the system is today, any significant challenge to the United States, which is seeking to dominate the peoples of the world, and is the greatest threat of war in the world, is a good challenge. I don't approve of some blowing up some building with people in it and all that sort of thing. But I understand why it happened. And it's extremely important that we all understand that. That's a different thing, saying I'm giving political sympathy to it. On the other hand, I understand why it happens. I understand what this government represents and has done around the world. This government is hated and reviled because it has resulted in the mass murder of millions and the starvation of millions of others. That's why this government is hated. Not because, oh, they're just idolizing and jealous of our rich lifestyles. Well, their lifestyles and the West, the reality is in the West, they consume most of the energy. They have most of the material resources they get from other countries, either through unjust trade or outright military conquest. And all of this stuff has been going on for years and years and years. Now they want to attack Iraq, the second largest oil producer in the world, which is next to the first largest oil producer in the world, Saudi Arabia. And they want to take over in a military conquest of that country. That's why I said they were talking about running the country for a year with a military regime. Now, my understanding is that they're talking about no less than 7 to 10 years of a military, of American military government, after which I suppose they'll get a reliable flunky or reliable puppet to run the regime for them. And my understanding is that there are people in the Bush administration that are openly talking about and planning towards a similar conquest of Saudi Arabia.
That's right.
And to take over those oil fields. See, what they are afraid of, and some of these things that have been said by various analysts and theorists and so forth, some of them have. I'm just going to give you my take. They want to control all world wealth. The West cannot depend, cannot survive without controlling oil wealth. They have tried to overthrow the government in Venezuela. And is anybody in their right mind think that they tried to overthrow the government because they didn't like what that guy was saying? I mean, who would have believed that? Because if you know, I give you a deal and you go in the corner and relax. But they want to control Venezuela as well. It's a major oil producer. And so it's important to understand that the United States has gone from being a producer country to a consumer country. And it is, as Bill Scott here says, when you become a consumer, it will change your world. That brother's bad. I like it. It's my favorite. It will change your world. Yeah, these people are confronted with a new world now. And all the stuff they're doing is in response to that. You know what I'm saying? And so the war is not just a moral, passionate issue that you should get out there and fight for. You know, you got to understand that it really is an attempt by these people to hold back history and to keep this corrupt system in place, which is destroying the planet. You know what I'm saying? That's really what this is about. And so if somebody like me with very little education, other than books in the prison system and so forth and so on, can understand that, then clearly the folks who've been to college, I guess, can understand that because they supposedly have a framework to work with. And so therefore the movement, we're talking about anti-war movement, but we're really talking about a movement that's going beyond anti-war, but an anti-capitalist movement that is trying to destroy the world capitalist system. Some people call it imperialism, whatever. I think it's going beyond just imperialism, the old concepts of imperialism. I think it went beyond that with the first multinational corporation of the new sort. We can't stay in the damn face. If people are still spouting shit from the 1920s and 1917, and all these things have happened over the years, what in hell's name is wrong with us if we continue to buy into that? So now I think, from our standpoint, and how long have I been going here? I don't want to talk to
you. You may want to, so that they have time.
Okay,
this is a question.
All right, that's what I was asking.
But you may want to wrap up where you're at, and then that's okay, maybe take 5 minutes break. So
okay.
You want to get,
don't go away.
And then get questions.
All right.
That's okay?
I got to roll in good. I'm sorry. There's too much time. And nobody fell asleep, did you?
No.
Okay, so anyway, I don't get much opportunity to do this. Certainly I haven't done it here for a while. But I'm going to wrap it. So the reason why we're activists, the reason why we're opposed to war and all these sorts of things are not just moral and all that. And we need to build a new movement. This new movement needs to understand the ways of the world, how the world has changed, how, you know, peoples of color have become instrumental in more ways than one, in terms of the material resources that are in their countries, even in the United States, in terms of the greatest contradiction is with peoples of color, and how that all factors in so that we can build a movement that everyone is included. As it stands right now, I don't think that, certainly the anarchist movement has built such a movement that is inclusive of peoples of color and other poor folks and everything. And I think that's part of what we are trying to address. As the brother said, it will be hard medicine sometime. You will have to criticize people and all this kind of thing. But it has to be done. And so I think from that standpoint, that's what I'm about. That's why we're trying to create this conference to be held next year, and try to get people of color to come to it, try to build a network of organizers of some sort. You know, that'll all be determined at the conference. We're trying to get anarchists, so-called white anarchists, to understand about the responsibility of supporting physically, politically, materially, supporting these movements of color. As of this point, I can just tell you that the attempts we tried with Black Autonomy, we've got more shit from folks than we got support.
Mm-hmm.
We got more criticism, we got more attempts to destroy us and delegitimize us than we got any real serious support. So
If you, but everybody gives lip service to seeing people of color in the anarchist movement. You give lip service to that. So we are saying that put your ass where your mouth is. Put your ass on the line and put some resources out there. So you can support people, but not control people.
That's right.
Uh-huh. And when we come to that stage, I think then we will be able to develop something that's really important. So I thank you very much.
Thank you.
Glad I got you.
Try to do like a 5 minute, you know, or so break, right? But I'm going to also, this is donation for Lorenzo's book, right? So between this going around and okay, we want to bring some questions, all right? And open up some discussion. Now, if a lot of people raise their hand, I'm going to try my best to make sure I keep it in order, you know, and hopefully, you know, people won't feel, you know, about any questions that they want to ask, you know, like that. All right, where would we like to start? Questions, comments? But let me say before you do that, right, I transform when certain organizations use these opportunities to, like, get that line, I transform, all right? Then I go blank, and after that, them people might be in bad shape. I don't want that to happen, all right? But this is a discussion. This ain't for nobody else's who got the correct answers, and they just want to come in here and use the platform, so, all right?
Right.
Okay. Questions? Comments?
I actually have a comment.
And before you can you just, who are you?
No.
What's
no.
Your name? You got red on.
You got black, white, and red, actually.
Shut up. No, I just wanted to, before Lorenzo had said that folks need to go into communities and really connect with folks. And I just wanted to make a comment to be clear that folks go into their communities.
Exactly.
Where they're from. Just so that there's no mistaking, like, don't come into people of color communities if that's not where you're from.
Exactly.
And, you know, build alliances, build solidarity, but don't try to come in, like he was saying, don't come in with the answers and don't talk at people, but go into your communities. And because that's the harder work,
yeah,
that folks tend to not want to do. They want to come into people of color communities, but not go into where they're from.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And in the back, did y'all hear all that? Okay.
Well, you know, I thought I was a little bit clear, but you can always use reinforcement. I think also, one of the things I'm writing about here in the new version of Anarchism and Black Revolution is how white radicals and anarchists who don't even go into white working class communities in the black community is a travesty. I don't know how a group can think it has any validity whatsoever in terms of any social change if it doesn't even go into white working class communities. I can't do that, and I shouldn't be forced to go there anyway. But people who are from those areas, or even people who have access to going to those areas, should be doing that and organizing. And building a base of support against racism and support of communities, in support of struggles, social change, and also countering fascist ideology, because it's plenty of it there.
Oh, yeah.
So she's right.
Okay. On carrying on with fascist ideology, I'm obviously, well, I'm Australian, and you were there with the Anarchist Black Cross in Australia recently, and maybe you sort of shared a little bit of your experience in with the triad of, you know, terror against fascist countries.
Well, those of you who don't know, in 1997 I went to Australia. I was invited to Australia by a group of Aborigines and also an anarchist organization called the Angry People, among others, primarily Angry People. And because they had known that I was one of the organizers, principal organizers of the protests against the 1996 Olympics, and the 2000 Olympics were going to be held in City Street. And they, you know, we had hooked up, and they, I gave them some solid ideas and so forth and so on. So when I elected to go, you know, he put the fair up and all that stuff, and I went to fair in July of 1997, got there, and almost immediately was attacked by a right-wing politician, Pauline Hanson. And Pauline Hanson was also a candidate for, was the prime minister, I think it was. And she was running against John Howard, who was a so-called liberal, but not liberal in the sense of the United States liberalism, but liberal labor or liberal something or other.
Liberal fascist story.
Okay, I said that down. And, well, anyway, she had claimed that I was there, that I was a terrorist, and I was there to get the Aboriginal guns and teach them how to shoot the country up and all that kind of stuff, lead a civil war and all this crazy, alarmist garbage. And I was ultimately questioned by the authorities and summarily arrested, taken to jail, beaten up in jail, and you know, thrown in prison there, into a deportation prison. Now, it's interesting that I would probably be there right now, because there have been some people in that place I met that have been in there 3 and 4 years. I'd probably be there right now if I didn't have international support base. And I was able to, before I went, before they grabbed me and took me out, I was able to talk to one of the sponsors of the talks there in Sydney. It was Brisbane, actually. Who put it on the internet. And in a short space of time, days, there were demonstrations in 17 countries. And in the United States, there were like 10 to 12 cities where there were demonstrations in front of the Australian consulate. Now, what the deal was, one of the things that I had found out and started incorporating in my talks, I got a chance to give maybe one or two talks before they grabbed me up. The Ku Klux Klan was in northern Queensland state. I can't remember the name of the little town now, but they were in northern Queensland state. Sorry? No, I think it's sort of a V, a little short name. I can't remember right now. But up there, they were attacking black people. And at first, I thought it was just doing what the Klan always does. But it was in relation to some kind of land claim thing or something going on up there. I don't know. And I brought this out, mentioned it in one of my talks, and when I said this, and of course, the election, I said that the government's down with this. I call them the Howard Hanson Coalition. That they were down with the same kind of racist garbage. And so I was talking about the whole history of genocide and so forth, and I knew about it, and I was going to tell the people. Well, anyway, all these things ultimately resulted in me being arrested, dragged before the Ministry of Immigration, thrown into jail summarily, taken into a cell and beaten up pretty thoroughly, you know. Now I broke the glasses on my face, in fact. I was handcuffed the first night there, you know, to the bed. And then after I had managed to get more information out of the attorneys, I had got an attorney, well, one solicitor was from South Africa, and the well, you know, they got the solicitor barrister system. Let me get this straight now. The barrister actually goes into court, I think that's right, and the solicitor files the papers, whichever. But anyway, the two of them were pretty progressive guys. I managed to get to see them. And they raised my case up and took it all the way to the Australian High Court, which is the equivalent of the Supreme Court of the United States. And the court there ruled that I was not given of what they call natural justice, which is the equivalent of due process of law under American law. And in fact, even questioned them so sharply that they admitted that they only went after me because I was a political figure. I'd come there to speak with the Aborigines. There had never been an African-American figure up to that point who had come to identify with the Aborigines, you know, and had a position that the government should give them back their lands and that they owe them reparations. And so, as a man, they made a political target out of me, is what it amounted to. Now, I almost got killed in there, like I said, and I almost didn't get out of there. If it had not been for the international uproar, I'd be there today. I'm firmly convinced of that. Or in some ground somewhere. I'm firmly convinced. So that was a pure victory for the anarchist and radical movement in this country. And I tell people that. Actually, my walking around out here now alive, period, after the American government locked my ass up for life, plus life, is a victory. You know, for the movement of the anarchist Black Cross and other forces in the anarchist scene. So, hey, it's a fact. But that's what that was all about. And it was important. I'm going to write about it. In fact, I'm writing this now. I'm writing my memoirs and putting some of that stuff in there.
Next step.
Okay.
Brooke,
do
you have
any
questions?
I just wanted to say, if anybody doesn't want to get taped, just let me know before you speak and I won't.
Yes.
What was the name of the person you said originated the concept of Black Power? I didn't quite catch the name.
Willie Ricks.
Ricks, R-I-C-K-S.
C-K-S, yeah. His name, he calls himself now Mukasa Ricks. But he was an organizer from Chattanooga, Tennessee. I knew him personally. He lived in my neighborhood. And I patterned myself after him in many ways in the early stages. He was a person, he was typical of the organizers in that period, you know, who gave their whole life to the struggle. You know, some of these organizers were in college. They quit college. They gave everything up and went and became full-time organizers. Now, you can't even get some of these kids to leave school for a day. There's nothing like, you know, giving your whole, turn your whole life around to engage in struggle. So, Ricks is an important figure. Not much has been written about him, however. And that's a shame and disgrace, you know, that he hasn't been given more attention. He and E.D. Nixon is another figure, historically. E.D. Nixon was the person who actually planned the bus boycott in Montgomery, Alabama, that brought Dr. Martin Luther King to prominence. In fact, he was the one who picked Dr. Martin Luther King to be the figure.
E.D.
Nixon. So, and he also is another person who has pretty much vanished in history. Those people. Okay,
right here.
I'm asking you too, as much as you can speak up, so we can make sure everyone's
asking. Okay, yeah, I wanted to kind of take the idea of anti-racism within the anarchist movement, because I think that's one of the things that the anarchist movement is kind of completely without. Mm-hmm. And how did you, because like a lot of times I'll go to an anarchist meeting and a lot of it is just an internal awareness, like an automatically just knowing how many people of color are in the room and mm-hmm. like an, just automatic things that you know from living a life of a person of color and like how do you kind of infuse a sensibility into people who don't have much emotional stake in it and do that without alienating yourself or alienating them and like fuck the white guilt but like take the white guilt and be proactive with it mm-hmm. and you know.
Well, first of all, you keep the ricks. The thing is, you know, I think what you bring up is a significant point. See, I think one of the prime objectives of a so-called predominantly white anti-racist or radical movement has to be in support of peoples of color first, in the first place. And as far as the weaknesses, one of the weaknesses of the anarchist movement I've always seen is that they don't empower those people of color. They just got them in there. You know, they'd be happy to have black faces sprinkled or brown faces or whatever sprinkled in the room, but they don't want to empower them. And so one of the things that you have to do, if the people of color are starting to do this is the point of this discussion in a large sense, is that they are starting to demand their own voice in this movement.
Now, there's been a number of ways attempted to do it within organizations that are primarily all white or majority white. People have demanded or set up their own caucuses. That ain't necessarily work. But then now people are looking at creating autonomous tendencies and then talk about how they relate to the anarchist movement. You know what I'm saying? But the thing is, I think that if you don't empower people, then all of the rest of it is bullshit. Oh, we're sensitive to your plight. That's like Bill Clinton used to go around before he was getting elected. I feel your pain. You know, people are out of work, starving to death. He feels the pain. He's riding around in a limousine. I feel the pain of the worker of this country. I sure do. He's riding around in a limousine and, well, I could say other things. That's too vulgar. But so I think the thing is that people have to have power. They don't got power. If they, you know, if they're just there because they're a black face or a brown face in the room and their ideas are not considered and made a part of any planning and all that kind of shit, like the left does, then I think it's a fraud, a gigantic fraud. I mean, you shouldn't worry about somebody's sensibility. Tell their asses what the shit is and let that be it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and don't spare any criticism. You know, that's what I'm saying. So I think that is the real thing. If you feel that you're not empowered, then you can't, in genteel fashion, say, well, hedge around the bush. You've got to tell people, you know, like, look, this is not right. You know, I ain't going for this. You know, you've got to tell folks and find your voice. And that's what happened, you know, and it's interesting that in the left history, especially in the 60s, one of the things that happened and has never gone, nobody's ever gone back on it, is that the peoples of color, various peoples of color, found their own voices, found their own organization. I remember something that one of the moving figures inside of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee said, James Foreman said, we have found our position as a leadership. We are not giving it up.
Yeah, I was wondering, do you, in Chattanooga, do you talk to other African Americans about anarchist ideas, and what kind of response have you gotten?
Well, I'm no longer in Chattanooga, and to be quite honest with you, I was never able to develop any so-called, I can't say that I never did develop an anarchist organization there, because Black Autonomy did have a base there, and created the Black Autonomy Cop Watch, which was a very effective organization, which, you know, clearly identified with Black Autonomy. You understand that there, because there's no tradition of anarchism, white folks got a different situation because the people have heard of anarchism, they're aware of it. So we've got to create a new ideological tradition, create a new way of people thinking about this. They got to see it within their own culture and all that kind of thing. So I couldn't always just come right out and deal with anarchism as politics and have people understand that, you know. So we had to build it around programs and issues and talk about the state in terms of what the police were doing, what they actually do, not theory, what they actually do. And then talk about how this state, this is the government, they'll never change. They ain't gonna never be your friend. There ain't no Justice Department coming to save you and others. We had to fight all those trends that people are, all those myths that people have about the government. We had to fight all that. So we did it, but we didn't create an effective organization that was just an anarchist organization, per se, you know, of people of color. But I'll tell you this much. Let me just say this. If I had been in an urban area, if I'd been in a place like this, or Philly or somewhere, I really believe that I'd have been much more effective in doing that, because I would try primarily to build that kind of organization as opposed to just building organizations that had anti-authoritarian politics maybe, but at the same time didn't identify themselves as anarchist organizations. I think that anarchism has to be redefined there also, and that's another story altogether. Anyone else? Chuck on the brothers.
Thanks. Yeah. I guess this is a question about community organizing. I mean, I just think about, you know, like where I live and where I work, and I'm just trying, it just seems, sometimes it seems like a really big thing to you know, just like, in, you know, working at like a supermarket in a suburb, like what would be like advice you would give to someone who works at a supermarket in a suburb? Like, how could you organize or get through to people like that? Or should I just figure that out for myself?
Well, you know, I'm not even workplace organizing, so. But clearly, you know, without getting set fire, now you didn't ask them whether they want to get fired.
And if that's a consideration, well, you know, you could be passing out literature and talking to people about it, obviously.
Yeah.
With co-workers as well as people coming into the store, you could be talking about it. But that might get you fired, but that's what you could do in that setting. But what I really think is, you know, you live somewhere. You it's a responsibility on you, you know, to try to find a way in your community to do some basis of organizing. It's more familiar to you since people know you, people know the community and so forth. They may not know what your politics are, and they may not like your politics, but at least you'll have entree to raise them. And so certain kinds of organizing is connecting with the community you're in. And even if you're an anarchist, you know, there has to be a way of explaining these politics to people that doesn't require you to use $37 words, you know. And there has to be a way of you explaining this to people that is within the framework of what they understand. That's why I said the best organizer is what we call an indigenous organizer, but all that means is somebody who lives there and is part of those people, you know. So those are the best and most effective people to do it. Yes.
Where was it first? Just what you were saying before about the way in which you know, one group would be targeted or given some rewards that another wouldn't. The experience that I've had personally is in the squatter movement down here, and it's another movement in the South Bronx. And the 11 buildings down here were just granted a form of normalization. And, you know, and we've been down since the mid-80s down here around it. And it's, you know, it's a diversity and each building's autonomous. And I'd say roughly maybe 50% people of color and so on, that kind of thing. Whereas the Bronx is 99.9%. But again, another 15 buildings going just as long, people of color. And the city normalized buildings down here. And, of course, the post call us parasites and, you know, the whole thing. And but the people in the ground, buildings in the ground, exact same situation, so it's nothing.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, maybe facing some sort of like eviction.
Yeah.
So that's just an example of the sort of the double standard that goes on. But my question to you is what? How do you explain, for instance, you know, over the years, some of us, personally, you know, made a lot of contacts with people in the Black and Latino community. East Harlem, South Bronx, New York, et cetera, et cetera. I grew up in MED. To get down with seizing the abandoned buildings and building communities of resistance in the neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
And talked to a lot of Black revolutionary people, talked to a lot of Latino revolutionary people, and a lot of my friends in these movements. And people who know me here for many years will tell you, I mean, we couldn't get people to really get on it. Like, oh, that's a white thing. Everybody knows globally, you know, 75% of the housing that poor people live in all around the world, they build.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know what I mean? I can't explain why revolutionary Black and Latino people, particularly educated people, are not dealing with the whole genocide around homelessness and the shelters and all that shit that's going down and seizing abandoned buildings in these communities, or at least advocating. You're talking about advocates. They don't even advocate it. I can't understand that. Everybody goes by the moment, and that's a genocide right in front of us every day. Right. A lot of things like, and it's always been the number one issue.
Okay.
And it's a struggle for land. I mean, it meets all those criteria, but there's nobody's moving on it, period.
All right. Well, basically, they don't respond because they're comfortable. You said they're probably the middle class. The left, much of the left, Black as well as white, and others are in the middle class. They're comfortable. And they're not going to assume the responsibility to organize around these issues. That's why you don't see a lot of activity in the left, period, around issues like that, these kind of class issues, unless it's some kind of poverty temp situation.
Right.
But let me just say this, that, you know, it's the same kind of dichotomy around the prison system, like I was saying. It's mostly poor black people, especially youth, who are black and Latino, whatever youth, that are going to prison. And, of course, women of color, black women and women of color, are the largest growing body and the largest body of prisoners in the American system as well. Even in the black community and the black movement and so forth and so on, there is just lip service to that. If it's even that much, there is no organization going on around it. And so this issue you talked about in the prison system is all linked. Bear in mind that I always say, and others have pointed this out as well, that the prison system is the new low-income housing project. So, you know, what's happening to homeless people, poor people, and they've been disempowered. One of the reasons there's never been a major fight back movement in this country around homelessness is because of this thing, like I said, about how many of the would-be activists and radicals are themselves middle class. But there's also the thing of they have been separated out and disempowered and made a criminal class, if not a criminal class, at least a class to be pitied. And so therefore, they're not, you don't see a lot of activism that could be happening against this country. You don't see a lot of so-called the advocates speak for them. That's the thing I told you about before. Advocates are speaking for homeless people. Well, if poor people themselves, I mean, think about if they use some of the tactics of even the old civil rights movement, go into hotels, go in there, jump in bed, shit, you know, come and arrest me in bed, you know, just do this, do that in enough cities. I remember one time they took over an old hotel in Atlanta, downtown, an old hotel. Now, this wasn't the Ritz, the old hotel. Man, that man was down there begging, promising everything. I'm going to build a new house and I'm going to do everything you want. Well, so it's, and just imagine if they had gone into luxury restaurants and going to restaurants and just start eating food and go into the, you know, the Hyatt Regency and just go get a bed. Just go right past the maitre d' and go up there and get in bed, you know. And if enough people did that, the disruptive effect of that, and start doing that as a movement, you know what I'm saying? So that you can't ignore me. See what I'm saying? This kind of thing it's a reason why it's not happening. You dig what I'm saying? And the reason is the same folks, the folks that we're supposed to be doing, like I said, that's a civil right. Those people, if they had a progressive bone in their body, if they were a force for social change at one time, they ain't shit now. They ain't nothing now. They part of the establishment. They get paid off to keep the rest of us in misery. And that's what it amounts to. So that is your answer. I know exactly what you're talking about. I've ran into it over and over again. So really the question is, and the task is to empower those people who are suffering directly from the disease. The patient who suffers from the disease has got to be the first one to speak up and fight. Yeah. I'm sorry.
No, don't call it.
Yeah, I'm sorry. This is
any
sad
first.
This is another question about community organizing. I have lived my whole life in working class people of color neighborhood in Brooklyn, and it's just now starting to get gentrified, and so there's a lot of like white faces in the neighborhood, and I've never really been involved with the neighborhood just because after elementary school I like stopped going to school there, and I just want to know if you could like suggest ways to get more involved in the community and organizing, just because I haven't really done that before and I want to. That makes sense?
I would say just restate it. I couldn't get it. Restate your question.
It's just like starting out, like doing community organizing. Like, how would you suggest doing that? Like, because I do view it like the neighborhood as my community, but not a community that I'm particularly involved in, and I would like to get more involved, but I don't really know how.
Well, obviously, you know, the first step, I've taught people to be organizers. We learned this myself. First is organizer, organize thyself. But the first step in doing any organizing is to very humbly go up to the door of people and ask them what they think about questions. Maybe even get a survey of what you think people would be interested in, or develop a survey, whatever, and talk to people. when you are, I don't know the specifics of this neighborhood. I don't know the demographics of this neighborhood. I just know that is the first step. So just go around and start talking to folks and get a survey together. Then after you get enough people who are interested in that, find out if they would be willing to come to a meeting. And if they would come to that meeting, would they be willing to then take another step of organizing? You know, so I think that's important. And that's how movements are built. Sometimes movements are built when people have house meetings. They're not meeting, you know, in a meeting hall like this. They're in somebody's house. And I know movements have started like that. So I don't know the specifics, so I can only give you generalizations. But I do know the first step is to connect with people. And that's something that we don't do these days. This is a lost art. Organizing on a community-based level is a lost art. Especially among
folks. And can maybe we have one or two more questions and begin to wrap it up? Yeah. But we got you. Do you understand?
No, I just wanted to add on to what you said in response to the squatting situation and the homelessness, organizing around homelessness. I think in terms of folks taking buildings over and putting themselves out there like that, it goes back to what Lorenzo had said earlier. There is a completely different risk for places where it's all people of color, where there in other places where there's more of a mix. Like, I mean, you said it yourself in terms of how the two are addressed. So in terms of folks that are already in a fucked up situation and in a fucked up place, trying to survive, like, asking them to give their lives again, you know, as if just, like, walking outside wasn't enough. Like, that's a lot to ask. And so if folks don't come up with that themselves, you know, it's not going to happen. And folks are not coming out like that because they're going to get, you know, shit on and killed and come at in ways that you're not, you know, and like in buildings where there's like more white folks in are not going to be come at that way, you know. That's just a significant difference. I mean, I'm not trying to like say anything. I'm just saying like why folks are not putting it out there like that. It's like there's a risk that's different.
There are 15 buildings in the Bronx. We've organized, you know, buildings, people have been squatting uptown, yeah, different places, and you're exactly right. I mean, the Harlem Reclamation Project, which was the late 70s takeover of like 25 or so buildings in Harlem, Newark, a bunch of people, and then I think in East New York, it was all in one weekend. Mass thing, like Operation Movement, the Young Lords. When Harlem Rec went down, the cops went in with automatic, you know, they came in, forget it, like that. So that's exactly the case. But, I mean, I've heard that so many times. You know what I mean? Hey, that's going to bring the heat, da 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 da. This is an opportunity to be free. Look at it that way. People say, oh, how do we know we're going to be here next week? I said, you could be here 10 years from now, and now I'm seeing those people, and they're there 10 years. So, again, for sure it's a risk. And obviously in certain parts of the city it's going to be a heavier risk. That's exactly true.
I think what she's really saying, though, is that people have to make that choice themselves. And they have their ability to do it and their desire to do it has to be based on their own needs and their own understanding of the struggle or understanding of the circumstances that they're confronted with. And I think that basically is a generalized question as well. I've known, you know, white radicals who come into the black community and try to preach soapbox to people about why they should oppose this or that, police brutality. Yeah, we know we should oppose police brutality. But if you are not able to get organized in a certain way in the community, you won't be protected. You'll have your ass out there by yourself. And then, you know, so you need certain forces in the community that you know the community to come and support you. And people from outside, no matter how sincerely motivated, don't necessarily see that. And the class privilege thing and the race privilege thing and all that factors into it, and they understand it too. They understand it instinctively. Many people think that because somebody didn't have a college education or whatever, they don't instinctively understand what is going on. They understand it very damn well, and they ain't going to get out there and get killed, regardless of the ideas in your mind, or mine for that matter. They're going to do it when they, you know, feel that they can win.
And they're going to have their own leadership. That's the thing about it. They're going to develop their own leadership. They may work in solidarity with you and all that, but they're going to develop their own leadership in that community, you know, and everything. And that's when it will happen. It won't happen because we want it to happen or somebody on our side wants it to happen. It's important to understand that.
This is a like a few part question, so too long or whatever you can answer part of it. But the first part is, what are some ways that you've seen white people support communities of color and struggles with communities of color in the past that have been useful? And then the second part of the question is, what do you see as some useful ways that white people can challenge white supremacy, specifically in the anarchist movement today?
Well, in terms of white people, generally, do what you do. That's the first part of the first I'll answer that. And you're asking me, how can white people
support communities and struggles of color, and then being part of this challenge white supremacy and anarchism?
Well, they gotta organize and get organized themselves to even be able to do it. Otherwise it's just a fond wish. But I think that, first, as we were talking, not abstractly, but at the existing anarchist movement or the existing so-called left or tendencies, progressive tendencies, they've got to be able to, they've got to support those organizations and those movements tangibly. First of all, there's bullshit about, I'm down with you while you're going down. That's bullshit. You got to support movements. Give them material resources. Give them political support. Give them whatever it takes for them to survive, and even what it takes for them to win. That's important. You've got to be a political ally, not an opportunist waiting to suck the blood of a group after it's been destroyed by the state, and they recruit their cadre of their people of color into your movement. You've got to become part of that struggle, and you've also got to take those risks along with them, you know. So I think that's important. I can't, in a broad sense, give you all this stuff about what you got to do to be, you know, respected and all that, but that will sure as hell help. So white people, as an organized political force, which is what I'm interested in, I'm not interested in the individual stuff, they've got a hell of a lot more than, white people have a hell of a lot more, and have a lot of access more to material resources,
sure,
than practically any black organization, even the so-called NAACP, you know, these bourgeois groups. That's the first part. That's all I can give you on that. The second part is, in terms of the anarchist movement, what should they do? Well, much of that applies to them as well. But the anarchist movement has an additional problem of pretending that there is no such thing as racism within their ranks. And if you become an anarchist, if you become an anti-racist, oh, you can't possibly be a racist yourself. You now, well, I'm changing my identity. I'm a race traitor now, and so forth. I'm changing my identity. I'm not white anymore. I won't bear that guilt in you. I'm a good guy now. Whatever. I'm simplifying it. But the point is, the anarchist movement has to build a way of challenging white supremacy within the movement. Every day I'm one of those organizations. I run into a bunch of bullshit.
Yeah.
I can just sit and tell you hours of shit I run into. In North Philly some years ago when I was in IWW, they had a group meeting there, their general membership branch meeting. All white folks except for me and one other guy, half black. I call him half black, but he was half a person, you know. But anyway, we were there, and all these white folks just screaming and hollering at each other about inane bullshit that didn't have a damn thing to do with nobody but themselves. Don't work in class. And all these people from the middle class and doing good. And when they get through playing their game, they can go back to their privilege. But anyway, the lighting broke down. So they went outside. and it was a bright summer day. He went outside, and they were in the back, pooping and hollering back there, in the back of a housing project or establishment or whatever, estate. And people came back and heard all this hooping and hollering. What the hell's going on? Who are these crazy white people back there? So what the hell's wrong with you people raising hell? What's going on here? We're at a meeting. We got a right to be here. He said, what? You got a right to be? What rights you got to be here, white man? What's going on with you? Are you out of your local mind? He said, well, you got a right to be here. Do you know somebody here? You live here? What is this?
We own that building. We own that.
So, well, that don't give you no right. You know, you don't live here. You ain't got no claim to this place at all. And you don't look like the people who live here. And, you know, then they turn around, you know, after these people at the front of them, and they look at me and say, Lorenzo, don't tell them we all right. I said, what you mean we white man? So they kick your ass, they just kick your ass. And this is a real story. This ain't, I wish I wasn't making this bullshit. This is a real incident in North Carolina. And I mean, and they didn't invite people. Said, well, look, here's what we're doing. We're so-and-so. We're out of the You can come on and have a seat. We'd be interested in you joining the group or blah, blah, blah. No, this is our meeting.
Our meeting? The white folks' meeting? You are not welcome. We don't fool with your kind of people. We're better than you are.
You know, that kind of attitude. You know, I after that, I said, I got to get out of this shit. I don't know what the CCC is with all these crazy people. Fighting these people ever since I've been in this thing.
We're not racist. There's no such thing as racism. Lorenzo lodges these false charges of racism. He's a racial disruptor.
All this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Hey, I got all this stuff. I ain't been back fooling those people since. But the point is, you know, this is typical of the anarchist. I've run into other instances of it throughout the 29 years I've been an anarchist. I've run into this over and over again. This is what has led me, in fact, to the point of view of saying, you know what, we're going to have to create an autonomous tendency. We're not trying to create a nation, state, and you know, you got to have some card to get in all that. But what we understand is that we don't build a tendency of peoples of color. Our rights and our wishes and points of view will never be respected within this movement. And people only respect you when you're well-organized and you're strong. That's just the reality. That's just the reality. Don't mean you made it white folks. I was on the floor last year, at the San Francisco book thing they have there, the Anarchist Book Fair.
Yes.
And some guy walks to me and said, hey, Lorenzo, you're hard on white people. I said, I am. I said, happened. Have you heard about me killing one lady? Have I sold it into slavery? Have I racially profiled it? What the hell is this? How am I hard on white folks? Because I challenge the racist bullshit that I see in the anarchist movement. I'm hard on white people. I don't want to hear some white people. I said, I like white people. Well, of course, I like or dislike white people. It's a question of social justice. And are these organizations who claim to be for the freedom and salvation of everybody, are they going to be true to their mission?
Yeah.
That's what it is.
We got one last question.
Yeah, I'm a little curious. Just you said two things there. You said you're talking about sort of meeting people where they're at and not trying to impose like a program on people and telling them how to do things. And then speaking about like Al-Qaeda, you were talking about how there's, you know, movements that we might not sympathize with politically, such as, you know, the Taliban or whatever. And I'm just sort of curious how you reconcile these two things together. Because me personally, as a Muslim, like a lot of times, I'm fed up, you know, with the left movement in this country in general, because there's no room, you know, where we're patriarchal, or this, or that, whatever. And I'm curious how you sort of, those two things come together for you. Like, not trying to impose a program on people, and yet having, you know, groups that are maybe doing, you know, certainly anti-government things, you know, that you don't agree with their entire sort of worldview or their whole program. And how you can see those two things sort of,
reconciling with each other. Is that
well, it's not my responsibility to destroy those organizations. First of all, that's the role of the United States government. You know, I think it's important to understand that, yeah, there are forces in the world that are opposed to the United States government. Let's be clear about that. And although you may not have any political sympathy with them, Hamas or something or other, you understand that, you know, in the world as it is today, and in the Middle East, the PLO is not a progressive organization anymore. The leadership isn't progressive in a real serious way. It's like a lot of organizations that appeared at a historical moment, and it may have done some good things, you know, at that time, but it basically outlived its usefulness and played out its historical role, its progressive historical role. And so I'm not in sympathy with those organizations. But that doesn't mean I don't feel that the people themselves don't have a right to their freedom. And that's important to say. If somebody blows up the United States, if somebody sets the master's house on fire, and I'm like, oh, master, I'm going to go and help you set your, I'm going to mourn with you and help you put your fire out. I'm going to sit there and watch your ass burn up. You know, it's just as simple as that. You know. So it ain't no reconciling. Oh, goodness, I've got on this side of my brain reconciling a tiny man. On this side of my brain, I'm not concerned about that. I understand that this country has created conditions for them to be attacked. So that ain't a question in my mind beyond that. But at the same time, when I say we do community-based organizing, what I'm talking about, and we're not trying to do, as many people do, to manipulate people into believing as we believe or whatever. When I was an organizer with SNCC, the beauty of them is that they would go into communities and seek out people who were of that community, train those people as organizers, and then move on. They build local groups for local mass movements, and then they go on. That's how a woman like a Fannie Lou Hamer came into existence or came to prominence. You know what I'm saying? So we're not talking about the same thing, but I don't give a, you know, I know about the Taliban. They're never historically been a progressive force. I understand that. But at the same time, the United States had no right under to go over there anywhere else and overthrow a government. Especially since they were responsible for creating those forces in the first place.
Yeah.
They're the ones that armed, in fact, I'm just saying. So it's something like Dr. Mix said before. He said that this government will take and create puppets and then turn around and destroy them. So from that standpoint, it ain't a question of me. I don't politically sympathize with those people, but I understand that in the world today, there are the many people in the world see the United States as an enemy force. That's what I see. All right. Anyone else? Is that it?
All right. Let's thank Lorenzo for coming. Good session, and I definitely think it was for me. You know, the whole purpose was we want to build movements. We want to build movements that is going to tear this monster down so that we can create the kind of world we need to do. So let's keep that in mind. And that's why, you know, we offer, you know, an anarchist perspective, anarchist ways of organizing, anti-authoritarian perspective, because it's about dignity and respect. You know, we come from very complex societies. You know, we're like New York City itself. We got so many different ethnic communities, class issues, sex issues, and everything. We have to figure out some ways to do it. There's no blueprint for it. So one of the things that I think that anarchism stands for is like, we got to find it. We don't have it. So we'll do it as we go. You know, we'll make that road as we go. All right? So let's take all these things back to our organizations and people. Let's confront the issues that we need to deal with so that we can get on with this revolution. All right? Thank you.